We have breaking news of sorts. It's not an entire shock, but it is still important. And there has definitely been a new development in the United States war against Iran in the Middle East. And that is now we finally have, we've been looking for this for a while, the entrance of the Houthis into the conflict. This was the statement from the Houthi spokesman just today.
Done its first military attacks with a barrage of ballistic missiles against its military sensitive attacks in Israel in the south of the occupied Palestine. This operation coincides with the heroic operations by the Mujahideen in Iran and Hezbollah in Lebanon. The operation has achieved all the goals with the help of Allah Almighty. Our operations will continue till we achieve all the announced and declared objectives. The former statement of the Yemeni armed forces until the aggression against all the fronts of resistance will stop.
Now, you may recall that when the Houthis entered the conflict in, I think it was 2024, against Israel, they had a very specific objective in mind. They said, we are going to fight against Israeli assets in the Red Sea as long as Israel was continuing its aggression against the Palestinian people in Gaza, as they saw it. And they said, as long as that continues, we will continue that as well. And every time there was a ceasefire, whenever that stopped, then so too did the Houthis attacks stop. So relatively speaking, what their objective said, once they were met, then they would stop. And of course, Israel was hitting the Houthis significantly. The United States joined in with that, both under the Biden administration, under the Trump administration. The missiles were never able to stop them. But when a ceasefire was announced, then they stopped on their own. In a similar way, they have, of course, they've hesitated for a while to get in. With a lot of speculation that they may have joined as soon as the United States attacked Iran. You know, this whole axis of resistance we've talked about with led by is Iran. And then there was Hezbollah in Lebanon. There was the Houthis in Yemen, and then the Hamas in the Gaza Strip. That was the so-called axis. And then there was Khatib Hezbollah in Iraq that made up another arm of all that. But they, in the initial phases, none of those people came in at all. But now here in recent days, Hezbollah in Lebanon has been engaging a lot more. And then now then here is the first statement and shot by the Houthis. And what it looks like is that they're having a very carefully calibrated strike. Now, this one specifically went against Israel. And according to information on the ground, the missile was intercepted and it did not cause any specific damage to Israel. But they said that they're in that soundbite we just played for you, they're saying we're going to continue on similarly like they did in late 23, early 24, until the aggression, and they, as they see it, stops against their brethren in the region, which is all those axes of resistance, as he specified there. They also have specified that if Washington intervenes, then the Houthis will obliterate U.S. military bases across Saudi Arabia and Oman, obviously just joining with what the Iranians are doing there. But the point being that right now, they're not going to intervene against the United States. So right now, it's against Israel. So what they're doing is they're creating the capacity to escalate and to take this bigger without jumping all in at one time. Now, I think there's also a very practical aspect of that. They would prefer not to get both Israel and Washington having them in their sights. I don't know whether it's going to make any difference. Once you hit one of them, it seems pretty reasonable to me that the other one's going to go after it. But then again, as I'll show in just a second, that may not happen because Washington has another problem, and expanding this to the Houthis might not be in our interest. More on that in a second. But of course, the biggest concern about the Houthis joining in is not whether they'll send a few missiles towards Israel or even U.S. bases, but what it may do in the Strait, not just the Strait of Hormuz, but adding to the problems of the Strait with the Bab al-Mandab there in the bottom, because you see that is where I think 10% of global trade, not just oil, but global trade goes through there on a daily basis. And if they were to shut that down on top of the Strait being shut down, and as you may know, the Saudi Arabians, you can see that east-west pipeline in the middle there, Going to Yanbu in the left side of your screen there in the Red Sea. Saudi Arabia has already started diverting some of its exports through Yanbu to get them out through the Bab al-Mandab in large measure in order to mitigate some of the problems in the Strait of Hormuz. If that one also gets shut down, then you have an even bigger problem that could basically far outweigh otherwise small, the Houthis. I mean, because they are a relatively small player. They don't have that many assets. They do have missiles. They do have drones. They do have the ability to shoot down ours. Remember, we've lost already, at least officially, 12 MQ-9 Reaper drones over Iran. But we also lost 7 of those drones over the Houthis in 2025, and one of the reasons why we stopped at that operation with the Red Sea and try to keep it clear, because they have the ability to shoot those down. So they're not without power, but it is limited. But if they decide to use it to stop down that Bab al-Mandab, then you can have a huge, huge strike crisis, because we've already shown, Israel has already shown, that it was not able to bring Houthis to heel, even with some really devastating missile barrages that we both the states launched against the Houthis in the past. They have shown that they have a lot of long-suffering capabilities and are not easily bowed. As a matter of fact, as this report shows here, the Houthis have a long history of not bending to much more superior air powers.
The Gulf states have gone up against the Houthis before, and this will certainly be something that will be raising the alarm. In 2014, Yemen's civil war began. In 2015, the Saudi-led U.S. and Western-backed intervention into Yemen saw them embroiled in the civil war, in a fight they did not have to get into that lasted for years and cost Saudi Arabia, the UAE, a lot in terms of blood and treasure. They extricated themselves from that, but not without it exacting a cost. And the Houthis, a much weaker force, went up against a coalition of 8 or more, backed by the US, backed by the UK, backed by every major weapons manufacturer in the world, airstrikes happening constantly, and they fought them to a stalemate.
So that's, again, just like with Iran, the Houthis don't have to defeat the United States or Israel militarily. They just have to survive. They just have to remain militarily and politically viable. And they have shown over an extended period of time that they can take all kinds of missiles in the teeth. They can take bloody noses, whatever you want to call it, and remain viable. And they'll continue to send missiles up. We've tried to get their mobile launchers. We've tried to find their sites for other kind of fixed sites. And we find some, but we don't find them all, or else they repair them or they find new ones. But the bottom line is they have continued to remain viable. Now, obviously, these hits have had an impact and have harmed the Houthis a lot. And that's one of the reasons why they have kind of gone back into the shell periodically. And they're not looking to carry this on further. They just have limited objectives. But right now, in coordination with everything else that's going on in the region, this is becoming a potential major point. So now then, the limited capability they may have in the Red Sea could be decisive when combined with everything else. And that is the big issue here with the progress of this war here. You keep having the United States and Pete Hegseth during the president's cabinet meeting a couple of days ago, again, was bragging about how we have control over all the air. We're putting the pedal down to the metal and increasing all this kind of stuff. And yet, even with over, and this is 5 or 6 days old now, 10,000 missile strikes into Iran. And now all this, you know, putting forward all the power to continue going in there and air power and missile power that the United States and Israel is launching, we still cannot bring Iran to its knees. We still have not opened up the Strait of Hormuz. And then now then the battlefronts are expanding. So not only have the Houthis joined, but we also have Hezbollah in Lebanon, which we talked about. And of course, Israel itself is on the ground in southern Lebanon. So they've got a two-front war there, both on the ground and in the air. But Hezbollah has now been striking targets deeper inside of Israel. And that's on top of the, now then we have the Iraqi, what's called the Khatib Hezbollah. Some of the Shia militia in Iraq are also coming to join the fray. So now you have Shia militias in Iraq. You have the Hezbollah in Lebanon, and you have the Houthis in Yemen, all of whom had been joining in with Iran. And we were concerned, the United States was, that they might have done that right at the beginning. Well, it looks like they have a phased approach. So now the United States has a bigger problem, because we have expended so much ordnance on Iran right now that now we are limited and we don't have enough to go after all of these players together. And that may have been their intention all along. The Iranians may have said, hey, we're going to just take the brunt of this and we're going to suck down all kinds of missiles and drones from the United States and Israel until our inventory start getting depleted. And then we're going to get these other guys who would be more vulnerable to a heavy barrage. Now then, maybe we don't have as much. To wit, here is another bombshell. This is coming out. This is reported by the Daily Mail, so this is not exactly propaganda from Iran or any of its allies. This is from the UK. This is coming in just overnight. That satellite imagery confirms Iran completely destroyed a billion-dollar U.S. THAAD missile defense system in Jordan. A cheap drone, apparently, according to their analysis, completely bypassed the most advanced American radar that the Pentagon is desperately trying to hide this massive humiliation. We've had some reports of some of these before, but even aside from whether that itself was second down, and by the way, let's just camp on that for a second. If we did lose the THAAD battery, you understand there were only, and I want to say seven worldwide that we had. There was also reports about a week or so ago that we were moving one of them from South Korea, bringing it in on the way here. Apparently, it's still en route. We're running low on THAAD missile interceptors in particular. So these things are like $12 million a pop, and we don't make the rate of production is very low. We definitely never planned on a war of sustain, which by itself was a problem. But now it's being manifest on the ground because there's certain categories of these Iranian missiles, the long-range ballistics, that only the THAAD even has a chance to take down. And if you now lose the batteries themselves, aside from the fact that the missiles, the interceptor missiles are also running low, you've got a really big compounding problem because you won't have that thing replaced. You can't just manufacture a new one in any kind of time frame that would fit inside this war. So we've just lost that. So now if that video is accurate, it's a satellite photograph. So it appears to be so. Again, this is by our ally UK, so not somebody else. And then that just goes on top of the other real problem that we have, that our stocks of interceptors are running low. The Royal United Services Institute for Defense and Security warns that Israel has used most of its Arrow 2 and Arrow 3 interceptors, while U.S. THAAD missiles protecting Gulf allies are heavily depleted. The report highlights the stark cost imbalance between Iran's cheap attacks and expensive interceptors to try and drop them down. And as I've said several times here, we have a problem in that we keep eliminating, so many things, so many of our interceptors and so many of our offensive missiles. I don't have a graphic here, but there's also real problems with our, this is when the Washington Post yesterday, which the Tomahawk cruise missiles inventory has also been used up. Apparently over 800 of them have been expended. And those are some of the best missiles that we have. And the problem is, what are you hitting? And there's lots of reporting that a lot of the targets have been going after some of these underground bunkers that we've been telling you about in some of these missile cities to try to get the doors knocked out, to try to collapse some of the launch points or the ability to get mobile launchers in or out, et cetera. Problem is, those can be replaced and repaired. And the Iranians have already, as part of their operations, they have construction teams and engineering teams that are designed to fix these shots when they come, because they obviously fully expected this to happen. I mean, anyone with half a brain would certainly understand that that was going to take place. So apparently they were resourced for it, and they were equipped both with capabilities and with personnel to be able to do that. Now then, that means we have to go into some of these and repeat attacks multiple times. Well, it doesn't take much to see that if you have used, according to the Washington Post, 25% of the entire American inventory of cruise missiles on a war that now that we're just over 4 weeks old. I think today is day 29. As a matter of fact, we're one day away from a full month of this. And we've used 25% of all of our cruise missiles, our best offensive missile that we have. And we've used huge amounts, according to Larry Johnson on our show, by his estimations and calculations based on publicly available information, that the PAC-3 interceptors are nearing depletion already. And you see the Arrow 2 and Arrow 3 systems in Israel are also apparently close to depletion. We're 1 month in, folks. Now, what happens if the Iranian side foresaw this and said, you know what, we can suck this down and we can keep taking all these missiles that you keep throwing at us and remain viable. We still have the ability to launch a sustained rate of weapons, and you don't have the ability to keep doing that. And let me show you one of the reasons why they have this capability is that video that Gary was showing you just a second ago about these underground cities. Here's a graphic. Obviously, you can't read the language there, but the images speak for themselves. You see those videos where we've shown many times. This is what it looks like from the outside. Most of these not just aren't deep underground, but in mountains. Mountains that are made of extremely thick and dense rock. So even though you may bring in some of these bunker busters, for example, and that's assuming you can get them in there because that comes at a risk, the ability to penetrate through all these levels of rock is just almost impossible. So all you're going to do is continue to hit that. And you see the exits on both the left and the right there. And those are things to certain, at least many of which we can see from space, from our assets or aerial drones, and we can hit those. And by all accounts, we have been doing that, but they're able to repair those because you can get the entrances. But if they're able to fix those from the inside and then get them back into operational capability, they don't have to be pretty. They just have to be effective. And if you can't get on the inside of that facility, then obviously you've got some real problems. And now that you see, we are really running into a big problem here that we just can't keep going like this. I mean, just think, if you stayed on the same trajectory here, if we've used a quarter of our entire Tomahawk cruise missile inventory in 1 month, and it doesn't take a genius to figure out, if you spread this out for three more months, if you stayed at the same rate of fire, you would be out of cruise missiles. What would you do then? Now, remember, don't forget that video I just showed you there from the Houthis, where they talked about what they've been doing since 2014, is that they have taken all these missiles in the teeth and they remain militarily viable as well. Hamas in the Gaza Strip, 2.5 years of relentless bombing, just almost turned the country into a moonscape, and yet they still retained military viability. Hezbollah, again, that's an even better example, because you completely obliterated all of their leadership from the senior leader all the way down to the generals and everything, and many of the mid-range leaders. And yet, after a period of time, they also withstood that. And even though they were continually bombed by the Israelis, wasn't in the news much here, but there it was a perpetual shot as they continued to strike targets in Beirut and elsewhere in Lebanon. And now you see, here again, they come out when at a time of their choosing, and they can still launch missiles and rockets towards Israel. Again, we're 1 month in. We're running out of Tomahawks. We're running out of interceptors for PAC-3, for Arrow 2, Arrow 3, and we're running out of our own PAC-3s, THAAD missiles. Everything is running low. What are we going to do if we get into just a few months of this and we've exhausted all of our key assets and they haven't? Because you see that mountain. I mean, show it again. This is incredible. There's apparently, there are scores of these things scattered throughout the country, not just one or two. And if they have foreseen what we can do and they understood the power of our attacks and that they had a system in place to defeat that, then you can see that this war will be a war of attrition, and that does not play well with us, which is crazy on the surface of it, because you think, it's as though someone you may have heard recently monotonously keeps saying that the United States is the most powerful military in the world by far. Nobody else is even close in the history of the world, et cetera. And now you can see, if this month stretches on to 3 or 4 months, maybe not even that, in some categories within another month, one more month, we could be into critical to the point where some aspects are out. And then now we have to start digging in the old stuff that has an even less capability to intercept stuff. And if the Iranians and the Hezbollah and the Khatib Hezbollah and the Yemenis, if they retain their ability to fire, you can understand we are going to be in a serious, serious problem. And that, of course, leads to desperation, which is why I'm concerned that we could be on the cusp. Nothing happened over this night, but we could be on the cusp of saying, you know what, we have to try something on the ground. And in an ill-conceived unresourced desperation that you didn't plan before. You have not had all the months of preparation, the logistics planning, the stockpiling, getting all the troops trained, equipped, making sure you've got enough of them, getting shortages filled, et cetera. All the things we have historically done before we engage in a large-scale operation, none of them have been done. And I fear that in desperation, because believe me, I ain't the only one doing this missile math that I just described to you. Obviously, the Iranian side did beforehand. The Houthis did beforehand. And now then they're playing their cards in a pretty carefully crafted way, and in a way that is really starting to be a problem for the United States. And we may take a bad decision out of desperation and go forward and try and do something that doesn't make any sense, that could make it enormously worse. If we go in on the ground, the chances of taking high casualties, because again, like all these other things, the Iranian side has foreseen all this and they have a plan to defeat it. They have a resource plan. They have foreseen all of these reactions that we've done, and they have had resource plans that up to this point have been very effective in countering us. Now, if you go in and you put infantrymen, especially light infantrymen or Marines on the ground, folks, they're going to suffer huge number of casualties, and the chances of them succeeding even tactically is very remote, and strategically or even operationally is off. There's just not any. The chances, in my view, don't even exist. And if we try that, that's going to be a real, real problem. Now, all of this is having an impact on the Iranian side, because they see this missile math. They see it going negative in our direction, and now they see the joining of the Houthis, Hezbollah, Khatib Hezbollah in Iraq. And they're feeling a little bit more cocky and confident. Here's the Iranian spokesman today showing just that.
تهران و فرماندهان ارتش آمریکا باید به خوبی درک کرده باشند که منطقه به گورستان سربازان آمریکایی تبدیل خواهد شد و راهی جز تسلیم در برابر اراده الهی مردم قهرمان و رزمندگان شجاع اسلام نخواهند داشت.
And listen, he's like, yeah, you can see that they're more confident now. Because they have by themselves already withstood everything we've thrown at them for nearly a full month now, and they are still completely viable. They took it in the face. They had a huge bloody nose. You may even say like the equivalent of a broken arm. They lost their supreme leader. They've lost a number of other senior officials, military and civilian, political. But they weathered them all because, again, they had a plan which they articulated beforehand that they already had replacements. They even specified for the senior leader, a supreme leader, all these other folks, every one of them had been replaced. Ali Larijani, their national security advisor, he was taken out. He was replaced right away to validate that they had a plan. They were prepared for it. Psychologically, they understood it. And now that they're continuing to operate here. But here's the problem. I mean, there's a couple of things I keep talking to you about some of these ticking clocks for the United States. You now have the math clock. I just had the interceptors and the offensive missiles. All of that is now a problem. And then there's this one here that keeps on its own, and it's now ticking up. This is a Brent, the price of oil here. This was as of the close of business yesterday. Was sitting at 106. So I keep telling you that's going up, and that is causing President Trump no shortage of anxiety. And now that's starting to play out that way, because that with the price of oil going up also goes with the price of gasoline. And that's going to make all these odd statements about how we're, knocking everybody out and how we're on the way to victory and all this kind of stuff that keeps happening that Trump keeps talking about. We've got some more to show you that in the intelligence brief, by the way, that's coming up here in about 40 minutes, 35 minutes, sorry. Don't miss that. That's one of our now more popular shows that we have. And we've got a lot of the best of what we learned this week and also some new stuff. You're going to see what President Trump and Secretary of State Rubio had to say about this, which is directly related to this. But that's one set of clocks. But there is another one that's going on, and that is in food. Because the global food supply is facing a dangerous bottleneck. And according to the WTO director general, said that the conflict had destabilized trade in energy, fertilizer, and food at a time when governments were already struggling with geopolitical and trade tensions, as well as climate pressures. It's no secret that the world trading system is experiencing the worst disruption in the past 80 years. And as we've mentioned several times, it's not just the oil coming out of the Strait of Hormuz. It's the big problem. It's also the natural gas and the feedstocks for fertilizer and several other things that are needed throughout the world. Those things are already causing very real political problems, geographic problems in different parts of the country, and agricultural problems. Because now then there's a delay already in the planting season, or things that are planted, they're going to need these kinds of feedstocks for fertilizers so that they get the right product out, the right amount of food grown. If you don't have a lot of these, then it's going to stunt the crop itself. It won't produce as much. And so you see, these are compounding. This is that even after you get some of this going, if you get this war concluded, even in the near term, there's going to be a problem, because some of these things are the prices are already locked in that you're going to have to pay later on because of the disruption itself. But if you don't get that turned into, you see, this is going to go to potentially a food crisis, not just an economic crisis, not just the price of a barrel of oil and all the things that go along with that, diesel, et cetera, because everything, certainly in the United States and most of Europe and many countries, runs on diesel fuel with these big trucks and some of these trains, et cetera. All of this is starting to be factored in. It's going to cause problems for everybody, not just those here. And it's going to get harder for officials in the United States to keep saying that everything's fine and don't worry about it. We're on the right track. We're about to beat them. They're all but defeated. They're begging me for a negotiated deal. You see at the face what's going on the ground. Nobody's begging the United States or Israel for any kind of a deal. They continue to strike. They continue to hit. There was a big strike in America on an American base yesterday at Prince Sultan Air Base. And we had at least one KC-135 tanker was destroyed, according to satellite imagery. At least one report said 12 Americans were wounded in that one strike alone. And by the way, the current statistics officially from one source I found said that 15 Americans were KIA. That's two higher than it was. I hadn't been able to track down where those two additional ones came from, but now 328 total wounded in action. That number keeps going up too. And that's going to start to cause some domestic political problems here in the United States. Ergo, one more pressure point on the president if we don't get this knocked out really quick. And so far we're not getting that done, but if you don't get the oil, the food, the fertilizer, the natural gas problems open up pretty soon, then the pressures will just mount from all over the world on the United States and Israel to bring this to an end, because most people recognize that this was a war of choice. It should never have happened. There was no imminent threat at all. And even though President Trump last night bragged on himself about how he had saved the world, as he put it, from this intransigent Iran, most of the world doesn't see it that way. In fact, very few people actually see it that way. And they see all these problems that I just described to you. None of them existed prior to us choosing to start this conflict that by all rights, nobody thought there was even any kind of a need for. So it's annoyance right now, but that's going to start changing if it starts really costing even our allies here. Now, one last thing I want to talk to you about, because I've mentioned several times that I'm concerned that President Trump, maybe not just that, you know, he's hyperbolic and he makes a lot of claims, or he lies about things just to make things sound good, but that there's some concern that he also has some cognitive problems. And I don't say that lightly. I don't say it in a pejorative manner. I just say, hey, there could be a real problem here. And there was one comment that he made at a speech last night that wasn't even related to the war, but is indicative that there actually is a problem. He's going to describe here a conversation he had with the owner of Toyota, a man he called Mr. Toyota, about a $10 billion deal that he said he agreed to with President Trump. Watch this.
I met Mr. Toyota in Japan. I said, what's your name? He's about 92 years old. Sharp as a tack. What's your name? Toyota. I said, you're rich. I said, do you have anything to do with automobiles? Yes. What do you have to do with Toyota? I own it. And I said, well, do you want to make an investment? Yes, we're going to spend $10 billion, spending $10 billion right now on building five plants. Everybody is. They're all coming into America. We're going to be hotter than we were.
Okay, see, the thing about that is he's conflating three different things. He's talking in his mind, and you can see the wheels turning there. He's talking about like that was one exchange, that was one situation. But he's actually conflating things that happened on three separate occasions expanded over nearly 7 years of time. First of all, Mr. Toyota, as he calls him, died 3 years ago. So there was nothing, even in this administration, he was not talking to anybody there. The current CEO is 65 years old, and his name is not Toyota, as I understand. So he wasn't talking about that. Definitely he's not 92 years old. So you're like, wait, what are you talking about there? Because this $10 billion figure is something that was from last year. But then even this is last year. This is October of last year. Toyota said it did not explicitly promise Trump that there would be a $10 billion investment in the United States. This is Toyota now. This is a public statement. Of course, it's been out there for a while. President Trump is talking last night like it's a done deal, and they have. He said that past tense, they have invested $10 billion. They're going to build plants in America, et cetera. Well, Toyota's saying, yeah, we didn't agree to that. So the meeting that he did have, by the way, with Mr. Toyota came in 2019 in his first administration. So he's talking about one thing from 6-7 years ago, and then he's talking about something else that happened last year, and he's talking about all of it like it just happened, and there's some kind of a performance on the ground that's actually coming into reality, and it's not. So is this an intentional lie or not? I don't get the feeling that it is. This is an anecdote. I get it. But along with a lot of other things, and we'll talk about that in the intelligence brief coming up on some other topics that do have to do with this war. But when you see him say stuff like that with sincerity, especially on something that's not a forced issue, that's not like where you're just trying to put a good face on something for a war effort. That's just something he's kind of recollecting. It's kind of just as musing as thoughts come into his head, but he's putting them all together like they're one event. And I'm not sure that he was even consciously aware that these things were spread out over time, or that Mr. Toyota died 3 years ago. That's a problem. Because if that's the guy that's making the decisions on sending American troops into a war on the ground that they can't win, has already sent us into a war that militarily he has set objectives that can't be attained at a reasonable cost or a reasonable time frame, that's a problem all by itself. We'll get into more of that, folks. Appreciate you on this quick war update. We will be back with you in about 30 minutes to do the deep dive intel briefing, and we will see you then.